Made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by a grant from International Galleries in Urbana's Lincoln Square Mall, offering crystal balls, dancing dolphins, pewter wizards, dragons, and fairies. International Galleries also offers custom framing services for your fine art print, posters, photos, needlework, and fabric art. Rush service is always available. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Center for East Asian and Pacific Studies, hosting its second annual film series showcasing six recent films from China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan on March 12th and 13th at the Virginia Theater. More information is available at 265-0640 or on the web at eaps.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Dansel, Jason Croft at the controls. Tomorrow morning on the show, we'll be talking about the decline and fall of WorldCom, and our guest will be Lynn Jeter. She's a journalist, has written a book on this. We thought with the recent indictment of Mr. Ebbers, the man who ran the company, it'd be worth going back and touching on that story again. She's authored a book. It's titled Disconnected, Deceit and Betrayal at WorldCom. That'll be hour one. And then in hour two, maybe you're thinking about a new car. And the next year, we will be talking with Rick Paul. He is the auto editor of Consumer Reports, and they have just put out their new automotive issue where they rate cars. So we'll talk a little bit about new cars and those that perform the best, they're most reliable, they get the best gas mileage, and also talk a little bit about how you can get the best deal if you're going out after a new car. And take questions, too. That's tomorrow in the second part of the show. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week. And we always welcome your questions and comments. Well, we are now at the time of the year when it's time to think about severe weather. It may seem, as I said in my promo for the show, it may seem that winter is never going to end. But the fact of the matter is that the first day of spring is only 10 days away. And it will not be that long before we're talking about severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. And about this time of year, people in the government and in Illinois and Indiana set aside some time to talk about it, just to encourage people to think about what they would do if they suddenly found a tornado was bearing down on them. And for the past few years, at about this time, we have welcomed into the studio here our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, to talk a little bit about these things, to talk about the severe weather that we're likely to have this time of year, talk a little bit about how these storms form and how meteorologists track them, and also talk about getting ready for severe weather. Your questions are certainly welcome. The one thing we want to make sure people understand is that this is not like talk to. There will be talk to, of course, tomorrow, and Mike Sola is on that job this week. So in the morning and in the afternoon, if you'd like to get a forecast for a place you may be traveling, we can do that. Not here this morning. This is a different sort of thing. Other questions, though, about weather and how weather works, you can call in with those, and I know that Ed will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much.
Well, good morning.
Here, I guess the kind of weather that we've been having lately is a good illustration of why it is that we call the spring a transitional season, because we have been bouncing back and forth between a little bit above average, a little bit below average. It's been warm. It's been raining. We've had snow. It's been below freezing. It's all over the place. But that's what you would expect at this time of year.
Exactly. March is one of those months. Right now we're sitting at 46 degrees. And Mike Sola tells me behind the second cold front to come through later today, it's 19 right now in Dubuque, Iowa. So there's some winter chill coming in for tonight. We're expecting a low of about 17 degrees. But we do have many warm days in the not-too-distant future, and with the up and down, you get the turbulent weather, and we're going into our tornado season, which really runs from about the middle of March through June around here. You can get a tornado at any time of year, but the middle of March through June is our prime season, so that's why we're doing this show. Last week was Severe Weather Preparedness Week in Illinois. Next week is Severe Weather Awareness Week in Indiana, so we're preparing and awareing in between.
Whenever we talk about this, I think we always like to remind people, as you have taught us, that tornadoes can occur and have occurred in every month of the year. So you could have a tornado in December. You could have one in January. Maybe not really likely, But it has happened.
It has happened. And back in 1967, there were some tornadoes in Illinois in the month of January, right before that big blizzard that hit the Chicago area and northern Illinois. So a lot of times in the winter months, if you do get a tornado, it's often followed by a lot of snow in blizzard conditions. Or if you have tornadoes around here to the northwest somewhere, they're really getting dumped on with snow, because it does take a strong storm system to pull moisture and warmth up from the Gulf of Mexico to help fuel those storms. But that sometimes happens in the winter months. So we do have the possibility of severe weather in every month of the year, and it has happened. But certainly once we get into the second half of March, the odds go up rather dramatically, and some of our bigger tornadoes in history have occurred in March and early April.
Yeah. Well, what's the, when you look at the bigger picture of the weather and look at those things that make the weather, the main kind of factors, what is going on at this time of year that causes this kind of volatility, both up and downs in temperatures, so that it could be really cold, it could be really warm, and from one day to the next it could be really cold and warm?
Well, we're in that transition season, as you mentioned. At the North Pole, the sun will be coming up in about another week for the first time in 6 months. So they've been in a six-month cool down up that way. And so there's a lot of cold air to the north that sometimes tries to get down here. But as the sun's direct rays are coming northward, hitting the equator early on March 20th, and then coming north of the equator after that, the days are getting longer now, and the sun's getting higher in the sky. So the heating of the tropics and areas just south of us is getting stronger. So you get that clash of air masses. Mm-hmm. And so your likelihood of storms is greater in these transitional seasons. Spring more than fall, because in the spring we have the added ingredient of the sun getting higher in the sky and the day getting longer. And that helps make the atmosphere more unstable, the solar heating. Whereas in the fall, once you go into November, the days are getting much shorter and the sun doesn't get very high in the sky. And as a result, the atmosphere doesn't get as unstable on a typical afternoon in November as it does, say, in April. Mm. So basically we have the clash of the air masses as we're in that transition season, plus we have the added heating, solar heating of the ground in the springtime with the longer days and the higher sun angle, and that makes the springtime the ripe time for severe weather.
Mm. You could, and we have had severe thunderstorms, so I guess you could have a tornado in the middle of the night, but it seems that around here, if you ask what time of day is it most likely that you're going to have severe thunderstorms, it's probably going to be, you know, sometime maybe 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, anywhere from around 3 in the afternoon to about 7 or 8 till around sunset is the prime time. But as you noted, tornadoes can occur in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. Just as they can occur at any time of year, they can occur at any time of the day or night. But we do see a large increase in the frequency of thunderstorms and tornadoes. And to get a tornado, you need a thunderstorm. So you first look for that high-frequency time for thunderstorms, and that would be in the afternoon, especially late afternoon. And again, that's due to the solar heating more than anything, making the atmosphere unstable, which leads to thunderstorm development. Sometimes there are other factors that can make the atmosphere unstable, and that's why we can get storms at other times. But that heating of the ground from the sun is definitely an important factor in producing thunderstorms.
If people have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks here. We do also have toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we will pay for the call, and that is 800-222-9455. Our guest is our meteorologist, Ed Kieser. We're talking about severe weather, generally the kind of severe weather that we get this time of year, which is going to mean thunderstorms and tornadoes, and what to do when those things hit. You can give us a call. I know that people continue to be confused about the difference between a watch and a warning. And we give these things all the time this time of year. And when we read the announcements, I think we try to be clear about which is which. But I still think people are confused.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do is both of them begin with the letter W, and that's the main reason. But a watch simply means watch out. That means conditions in the atmosphere are such that severe thunderstorms and tornadoes are possible. They could form in the watch area. So when you have a watch issued, pay closer attention to the weather. Watch out. Listen to WILL or your NOAA weather radio and keep tabs on the weather. And sometimes storms fire up very quickly, so just be ready to go to a place of safety. A warning, on the other hand, means a storm has been sighted or detected by the Doppler radar, and if you're in the path of that storm, you should then take cover immediately. So watch is the lesser of the two. It means watch out. A warning means take shelter.
We have some calls. Let's talk to these folks. Our first caller is in Oakwood, and line number one. Hello?
I have two quick questions, one of which is the local TV weather services, Channel 15 and Channel 3. I noticed that oftentimes they're long range, namely maybe 2-3 days out. Their estimates of what the maximum temperature or the minimum temperature is sometimes varies widely, like maybe 10 degrees. Now, I assume they all would read the same weather bulletins and so forth, so are there a lot of different forecasting services, and they vary a lot?
Well, I think kind of surprises me that Channel 3 and 15 would vary by that much, because there will be differences just when you have different meteorologists making forecasts. We all look at the same general maps, but we could come up with different answers based on our experience and just forecasting knowledge. Now, a lot of the people that are on TV are not trained meteorologists, so a lot of times you'll get the National Weather Service forecast more or less presented on the local television station. So that's why it surprises me that there would be such a big range. But then again, it might depend on who is on at a certain time, because some of the people on TV have meteorological training, some do not. So when somebody without meteorological training is on TV, they are probably using what the National Weather Service forecast is, which is what which is available to all stations. If you have a meteorologist on, or somebody with some weather training, then they may adjust the forecast according to what they see on maps. And I would hope that those that are not meteorologists would not be making their own forecast, because they're not really qualified to do so. But, you know, it could even come. I've noticed on television a lot lately, we've had people that don't normally do the weather doing the weather, and they might just misplace the numbers by a day. Sometimes you could just have a case where there's mistakes made, too. The reliability of what you get on TV is not always the best. It varies from station to station and person to person.
Okay, my other question is the official temperature, is that taken about 3.5 feet above the ground? Or
official temperatures are taken about 5 to 6 feet above the ground and in the shade.
In the shade.
So on a summer afternoon, sometimes the bank thermometers will read a lot higher. If the thermometer sensor is near a building or out exposed to the sunlight, it'll read a lot higher than what the official temperature is. So for consistency's sake, official temperatures are taken about 5 to 6 feet above the ground, about eye level of a typical person, and in the shade. The thermometer is sheltered so that you're getting a consistent temperature. Air flows through the shelter, but you don't have direct sunlight on the thermometer.
Now, how does the temperature change as you go up in the atmosphere? I know it goes down as you go up. Is that consistent, or does it only become consistent when you get up a certain height? Like I have a thermometer that's about 40 feet off the ground, and I try to compare it with the readings I hear, and I know sometimes it seems to be somewhat different, and I figured partly because it's up in the air and the wind, and it's higher off the ground probably.
Well, the temperature in the lowest 8 miles of the atmosphere typically does drop as you go up, but sometimes with a change in wind direction, you can have a little layer where the temperature gets warmer as you go up, and that's called an inversion. Now, at ground level, on a clear, calm morning, right at the ground, it's going to be colder than even at the official temperature height of about 5 to 6 feet. And your thermometer 40 feet up may read several degrees warmer than even what it is 5 or 6 feet above the ground on a clear, calm morning. Most of the time it'll be a little cooler up there, but sometimes it's not. So there is a variation and a changing profile of the temperature in the lowest few miles of the atmosphere from day to day and from day to night even. So that does change. But typically in the lowest 8 miles or so, the temperature drops as you go up. Then you get into the stratosphere where the temperature actually increases with height. Then above that, there's the mesosphere where it decreases. And then above that, it goes up again. But by the time you get up into the thermosphere, there's hardly any air molecules to make it matter.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. So just if we went out to the place where you do the official, measure the official temperature, five, 6 feet off the ground and in the shade, then if we took a thermometer and it stood at that same spot and held the thermometer down, say, a foot off the ground, there would be a significant difference between the temperature at 1 foot and temperature at 6 feet?
If there's not a lot of wind, typically about a foot off the ground or right down at the ground, it will be colder on a clear, calm morning and by several degrees. And on a sunny, calm afternoon, it would be a lot hotter. There's a bigger variation in temperature at the ground than there is even at 5 to 6 feet above the ground. And with the cooling at night, it's the radiational cooling, the Earth giving off the radiation. So if you don't have wind to mix things up, it actually gets much colder at the ground, which is a stable situation, I might add. When the temperature increases with height, what we call an inversion, you don't have up and down motions at all, and you attract pollutants in the atmosphere. In the summertime, late summer, when hazy, lazy days of summer, usually we have inversions that trap pollutants, and that's why it gets kind of murky and hazy in the atmosphere. But that's one of the reasons why sometimes I see we have phone calls, so I'll move quickly here. But it just brings up an interesting point. A lot of times you'll hear a forecast low of 38 or 40 degrees, yet you get frost, and you wonder, how can that be? Well, that's because it's 38 degrees at the thermometer level, 5 to 6 feet above the ground. But right at the ground, it could actually go down to 30 or 31, and you get frost. So a lot of times when in the fall or spring, we're forecasting a low of 38, we may mention scattered frost, and that's because the colder air is down at the ground level. Or in the case of your car is the ground elevated a little bit. So your windshield may be frosty, but you go a couple feet above that, and it's well above freezing.
Okay, very good. Well, let's go on to a caller. This is Champagne in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
You were, the last caller asked you about the variation in forecasts from broadcasters, and you explained that the ones who were not meteorologists would just take what the National Weather Service sends. And, well, I listen to you a lot, and I picture you sitting in a lab surrounded by monitors, and when people ask questions about travel, you can look at a map and tell them what the weather's going to be in San Diego. But how accurate is that picture? Are you at this moment in a radio studio, or are you sitting in your meteorological lab?
At this very moment, I'm sitting in the radio studio. When I do the talk to programs on Friday, I'm sitting in my meteorological lab where I do have monitors and I have paper maps hanging on the walls. And what you picture probably is close to reality there. So,
and where is that lab?
It's
University of Illinois?
Yes, it's right in the WILL building. About two walls through. I'm looking out a window from this studio through another studio, and on the other side of that wall is the weather office.
About 15 feet from here.
Yeah, Mike Sola is sitting in there, but I can't see him because there's no window between this room and that. But we do have a weather office, and we do have our computer monitors, and we do make our own forecast.
I recently had a chance to visit the Space Environment Lab in Boulder, Colorado, the NOAA Space Environment Lab, and I wondered, you know, do you depend on some of their information for severe weather forecasts?
Well, I think the research labs, what we depend on is they're coming up with better tools for us to use to make forecasts. So we don't access information from them directly, but the work that they do over time helps us with the information that we use. During severe weather situations, we look at a lot of different sources to not only come up with the forecast, but track the severe weather. Obviously, when severe weather is happening, we are looking at radar,
yes,
which is telling us where the storms are, and the Doppler part of the radar tells us whether there's rotation in the storms that may lead to a tornado. Ahead of that, we're looking at information from various short-range computer models that look at parameters in the atmosphere, such as wind shear, the change of wind direction and speed with height, the stability of the atmosphere, how unstable or stable the atmosphere is, because it needs to be unstable for storms to form, and we look at where moisture is converging to where it may rise to help storms fire up. We also look at information from the Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma. That's an arm of the National Weather Service that involves itself just with storm prediction.
Oh.
And they're the ones that issue the official severe thunderstorm watches and tornado watches for the entire country. And they also are constantly, during severe weather situations, putting out updates on what their tools tell them, because they have access to more tools than anybody else for severe weather. So we're looking at all of this stuff during severe weather situations to try to put together the best service for you.
Well, I imagine you have to be twins to keep track of all of that. But thank you very much. That's
all
just
right.
What I wanted to know.
Very good.
Thanks
for
calling.
We'll continue here, and our next caller is in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir.
And this is Belgium in Vermilion County, I assume.
Yes, it's that Belgium.
Yes, sir. That's the Belgium. The question I have is along with this tornado preparedness period you have here, I noticed that we never, ever, hardly ever, if ever, hear about tornadoes in any place else in the world except for mainly the mid portion of the United States. Obviously, it must have something to do with Canadian cold air and Gulf of Mexico or Caribbean warm, moist air. But is there any place else in the world that has them like we do?
Well, the middle of the United States is the most tornado-prone part of the world as far as getting the big tornadoes and frequency of tornadoes. Probably the second largest number of tornadoes occur around Bangladesh, and they also get the big tropical cyclones as well. So they get the double whammy there, plus the elevation of Bangladesh is not very high, so when a big storm surge comes in with a hurricane, they have horrific flooding problems. But tornadoes do occur on all of the continents except Antarctica, so there are tornadoes in Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, as well as here in North America, and in South America, they get tornadoes in Brazil and Argentina. Usually they aren't as big and newsworthy as the biggest ones that hit the United States. In recent years, I've actually heard more about tornadoes in other parts of the world than in the past, and I think that's in part because of the way news travels around the globe and the 24-hour news cycle. There's just more availability of information. But unless it's a really big tornado, you don't hear about it from other parts of the world because tornadoes usually strike just a very small area. And a lot of the U.S. tornadoes don't make news around the world unless it's a major outbreak or a devastating tornado hitting a big city, such as the one that went through Oklahoma City, the southern part of Oklahoma City, back in 1999, or the big outbreak of tornadoes we had in the central U.S. last year during the month of May. So we are in the most tornado-prone part of the world, especially for the devastating tornadoes, and that is, as you know, the clash between cold, dry air coming out of Canada and the warm, moist air coming up from the Gulf of Mexico, and we just have the right geography, if you will, to produce the big storms, but they occur in other places in the world as well.
Also, to go on for just a moment longer, tornadoes, Is it just because they're such a small event that we very rarely have them in large cities? Or
yes.
Do large cities actually affect them?
Large cities would not affect large tornadoes. I think there is the majority of tornadoes are what we call weak and generally have winds of 100 miles per hour or less, and weak is relative. A 100-mile-per-hour wind you don't want to stand out in, but some of the weaker tornadoes, some of the smaller ones, may actually break apart more easily when hitting an urban area just because of all of the friction at the ground, the surface roughness and all of that. But make no mistake about it, any tornado that is stronger, violent, F2, F3, F4, F5 on the Fujita scale can hit anywhere. And the reason they don't hit big cities as often is from what you noted, because they are small. And just when you look at the entire landscape of the United States, the highly populated areas still take up a relatively small portion of that. But bigger tornadoes, the more violent tornadoes, the ones that cause the most damage and kill the most people, can occur anywhere. And I've seen them go into cities. In the last decade or so, tornadoes have been noted in Nashville, Miami, Florida, Fort Worth, Texas, Oklahoma City, Kansas City last year, just to name a few. And tornadoes have hit in the city of Chicago before. To my knowledge, there hasn't been a big one right in the loop, but several have gone through the south side of Chicago in history. And you're not safe because you live in a city. That's the bottom line. You have to take tornado precautions whether you live in a rural area or in a city.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I think that it's good to be discussing this point, because I think that maybe people have gotten this idea that cities, because of their ability to soak up and radiate heat, because there's a lot of concrete and all the buildings and all that, that somehow that has the ability to alter the weather around them. That's the, I guess that's called the heat island effect. Is that actually real, and does that affect the weather much?
It affects the temperature, but I really think when it comes to big thunderstorms, every year when I talk to people, you'll hear that. You'll hear the old river valley argument. Well, I live in a valley, or the storms just track up that valley and miss me. And again, some topography in city versus country will have some influences on weaker weather systems. But if you get a good, powerful thunderstorm, the dynamics for that storm are aloft, and the storm is not really going to decay because of what's on the ground around here. Now, it is true that you get more storms in flat areas than mountainous areas, in part because of the flat does help the storms develop and keep moving. But I've even seen cases where stronger tornadoes will go up one side of a mountain and down the other. 1987, a tornado crossed the Continental Divide in Yellowstone Park. In 1985, a 65-mile-long path tornado went through mountainous areas of Pennsylvania, up one side of a mountain and down another, through forest. And again, the same thing can happen with cities. A lot of it is just luck, and the fact that there aren't that many violent tornadoes to begin with, and those that occur often, the odds are they're not going to hit a city just because of, again, the distribution of densely populated versus not densely populated landscape. But every once in a while, the big one hits a big city, and got to be ready for that.
Yeah. Ed Kieser's our guest. He's our meteorologist for WILL Radio and Television. We're talking a little bit about severe springtime weather, thunderstorms and tornadoes, and if you have questions, they are welcome. We want to mention, too, that Ed will be doing his now famous annual tornado show next month.
About a month and two days from now. It's April 13th. That's a Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. at the Beckman Institute Auditorium. We've been at Beckman for a few years now, and we'll be back this year. They have fantastic facilities, and it's a free show. It's Tuesday, April 13th at 7 p.m., and I hope to see you there.
Yeah, a lot of cool video of tornadoes.
And we'll have some new video. We're going through some video now. We'll have some of the old favorites, but we'll have some new video too. And even one little clip that I shot, it's not real impressive, but I saw my first tornado last year. And it's a good example of an invisible tornado. I've been talking about those for years, where a lot of tornadoes, when they first touch down, you don't see the funnel all the way down to the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's because the condensation hasn't taken place yet. And also the debris obviously hasn't gone up into the tornado when it first touches the ground. So if you ever see a funnel cloud aloft, beware, because it could actually be a tornado already sucking up the landscape.
So that's really what you're seeing. That's really what you're seeing. It's dirt and debris and stuff like that that the wind is picking up.
That's a lot of what you see. Now, over time, you also get the cloud of a tornado, the condensation to help. The two ways you see a tornado is the condensation that takes place in the vortex and also the debris coming up. But sometimes, many times, when a tornado first touches the ground, you don't have that all the way from the base cloud to the ground. So when I grew up, they used to say, well, that's just a funnel cloud up there, and you don't have to worry until that thing comes down to the ground. Well, tornado is a violently rotating column of air, and part of that column might be invisible at first. Yeah. So my advice is if you ever see a funnel cloud, it can be dangerous, and especially if you look below and you see some dust or debris coming up, it's already on the ground. It's already doing damage.
Okay. We have some other callers here. We have somebody on a cell phone. Let's get them on line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. In our volunteer fire department, we had a video, and it showed the tornado going into effect, and there was a comment made about on a supercell with the sunlight falling on the back of the cloud, it had an effect on the tornado, and I wonder if I'll hang up and let you answer that. But if you could address that, if that is really true. Thank you.
The sunlight on the back of the affecting the tornado on the back of the cloud, I don't think that would have much effect on the tornado. It might have an effect on how the tornado looks. A lot of tornadoes occur late in the day, so often you're getting close to sunset. The sun's rays are not very powerful by the time you get to near sunset, so the sun would not have an impact on the tornado itself at that part of the day. But if you're a photographer and you know what you're doing, or even if you're just happen to be in a place where a tornado forms, around sunset sometimes you'll get some interesting-looking clouds and lighting effects. So outside of how it may appear, the sun has no impact on the actual tornado itself.
We'll go to Aurora, line number 1. Hello.
Yes, I had a friend that moved out from New Jersey, and she moved out when the year that they had that horrendous Plainfield tornado.
That would be 1990.
And she thought tornadoes were worse than hurricanes. What is your evaluation?
Well, it depends on the tornado and it depends on the hurricane, because they come in different strengths. Obviously, tornadoes are much, much smaller in size, and the average diameter of a tornado is a quarter of a mile or less, and they rarely get over 2 miles in diameter. So a tornado is going to affect a localized area, but if it's a strong or violent tornado, it will cause more damage in the area it strikes than a hurricane will. Hurricanes, on the other hand, cover hundreds of miles in diameter and affect a much larger area. And tornadoes are spawned from hurricanes, so within an area hit by a hurricane, you can get a tornado. Most hurricanes will have wind speeds only equivalent to an F1 or perhaps an F2 tornado. So hurricanes will cause damage over a much larger area, and thus cause more widespread problems as far as power being out and stores being closed and the general cleanup over a larger area is worse with a hurricane. But I'd be more fearful of a F4, F5 tornado hitting my house than any hurricane. Sometimes hurricanes will cause massive damage over a large area if you get a lot of storm surge flooding or from the wind in the case of Andrew, which interestingly was also in 1990, I think. I think Andrew was in 1990 in South Florida, Homestead, Florida. Large areas were wiped out, and it looked like a giant tornado went through there. So they're really different storms. You don't have to worry about a hurricane in Aurora or Plainfield, though, just a tornado. But if I lived on the East Coast, I would be more worried about hurricanes because they're more likely than tornadoes. Whereas in this part of the country, I'd be more worried about tornadoes.
Well, she has since moved to Las Vegas. What weather type would she get down there? Would she get tornadoes?
Not likely, and if you did get a tornado there, it'd probably be a weak one. They rarely have tornadoes in Nevada. They have occurred. Las Vegas has had actually some problems in recent years where they'll once in a while get a big storm that causes massive flooding. But weather-wise, they don't usually have major problems in Las Vegas. It just is very hot and dry through the summer months. But once in a while, they'll get flash flooding in Las Vegas. Out of all the severe weather hazards, that's probably the biggest worry. Of course, some thunderstorms there are dry, but still any thunderstorm produces lightning. So anywhere there's a thunderstorm, you have to watch out for lightning, too. But
Talking about lightning, 12 years ago, my grandson Andrew asked me to ask you, why was there lightning? So I've been listening to you that I know of 12 years.
I think it's longer than that. But anyway.
He's 19 next week, and he was about 6 or 7.
Wow.
We're all getting old.
Yeah. Well, I think I remember you calling me during the drought of 1988. I know I was here then. But as far as lightning, it's basically due to differences in electrical charges between the ground and the cloud. And when the charge difference gets big enough, you get that giant spark, which is the lightning bolt. And that's basically what it is. It's just a giant spark of electricity. And it takes a big difference in charge between a positive and negative charge for that bolt to occur, because the air is actually a poor conductor of electricity. So the charge difference has to get great enough for the spark to occur. But it's just a giant spark with a temperature that's about 5 or 6 times hotter than the surface of the sun.
Well, one last thing. I know the weather's going to be bad. I've had 10 species at my feeder already today, so we're going to have some bad weather.
All right, well.
Well, good luck with
everybody
that.
Everybody get undercover.
Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. Just to stay with lightning for a second, I think this is an interesting fact, and I know that last week in the morning, Mike and Dan were doing some severe weather facts, and the fact that I think it's worth noting is that more people are killed by lightning than are killed by tornadoes.
That is correct.
Although more people are injured by tornadoes, apparently, at least according to the numbers that I have here. But the important thing is that when you look at people who are killed, more people killed by lightning than killed by tornadoes.
Well, and there's a good reason for that. There's a lot more thunderstorms than tornadoes. All tornadoes come from thunderstorms, but on average in the U.S. there's about 1,000 tornadoes a year, and there's tens of thousands of thunderstorms. So
your odds are a little bit better of the...
And any thunderstorm, every thunderstorm produces lightning, so any thunderstorm can cause a lightning strike that can hit somebody. So you don't hear about lightning strikes as much because it's usually one or two people at a time. And you're not seeing anything other than the person getting struck. You're not seeing a neighborhood being leveled, mm-hmm. which is the case with a tornado. So I look at it, tornadoes are like I hate to use this analogy, but tornadoes are more like a plane crash, whereas lightning strikes are more like car crashes. There's many more people killed in automobile accidents every year than plane crashes, but plane crashes make big news because there's many more people involved at one time.
Yeah. Let's talk next with an Urbana person, line 2. Hello.
Hello. You touched on this in your earlier discussion. Is the geography different between Champaign-Urbana and Chicago to affect the intensity and or frequency of tornadoes?
Well, there's a few things a little different between Champaign-Urbana and Chicago. One is they are farther north and by more than 100 miles, so the season comes just a tad later there. That's not to say they can't have a tornado or severe storm at any time of year. So their season may be a little different than ours. Not a whole lot different, though, but many times when we have severe weather, they don't, or vice versa. Sometimes we share in the same event. It just depends on how it works out. Lake Michigan's another factor in that it is a stabilizing force to the atmosphere. So Lake Michigan, during different parts of the year, can cause different things. That can help deflect a track of a storm. It can also help storms develop. If you have a cool lake breeze come in on a spring day, you'll have what's a small, what we call lake breeze front, which can help set the stage for the initiation or development of thunderstorms inland a little bit in the Chicago area. That's something we don't have here. And every once in a while, if you have the right wind profile, some of those storms that form inland a little bit can create a tornado. But on the other hand, I wouldn't say Lake Michigan always protects Chicago, because most weather systems come from the west and the lake is to the east. The lake does have a somewhat of a suppressing effect downwind a little bit at certain times of the year, especially in the spring. So if you lived on the Lake on the Michigan side of the Lake Michigan shoreline, your odds of a tornado are much lower, especially in the early spring, because of the cooler water of Lake Michigan stabilizing the storms a little bit. But once you get inland to where you have that intersection between that lake cooled air and the warmer air inland, that's an area where storms actually can fire up and develop. So probably the biggest difference between the geography in Champaign-Urbana and Chicago is you do have the lake that can play a role in certain situations. The lake does play a role in certain situations, and that doesn't prevent tornadoes from occurring in Chicago, but that does, from case to case, maybe make in some instances a tornado less likely, or at least determine the path of a tornado.
And historically, in terms of the numbers, is our area frequented more often than the Chicago area?
That's hard to say. The statistics on tornadoes in Illinois are a little misleading. If you look at a map, you'll see certain areas that have a lot more reported tornadoes, and then you see they match population. So the Chicago area has a somewhat of a maximum in tornado incidents over the last century. Then you start to see little maximums around Champaign County, McLean County. McLean County is number one as far as number of tornadoes counted in Illinois, but it's also the largest county. But you do have the Bloomington Normal Population Center in McLean County, where some of the less populated counties seem to have less tornadoes. So I would say the Chicago area and the Champaign-Urbana area, there's not a big difference in the number of tornadoes over the course of a year. Some years there will be more up there, some years there will be more down here. It just depends on how storms develop in an individual year. But when you look at history, I'd say both areas are equally dangerous enough that you need to know your tornado safety rules.
And lastly, in an El Nino year, or that string of successive El Nino years, were the number of tornadoes on average less, greater? Can you make any comment?
There's not really a good comment on that, because one, El Nino doesn't have a good correlation to weather around here most of the year. El Nino is strongest in the middle of winter, and the only correlation that I've seen, a good correlation between El Nino and our weather, is if we have a strong El Nino out there, we have less snowfall and a milder winter than average. Otherwise, there's other things that come into play. Oftentimes, you get down to just a few events a year that make or or not make a big severe weather season, and that'll just come down to smaller scale conditions coming together. So some have studied the El Nino and La Nina versus severe weather, but I think if you look at the statistics over the long haul, there's not enough that really points to one, or El Nino leading to a season being a certain way around here. Basically, there's too much randomness in all of it. El Nino is just one of many players in our weather, especially once you get to the summer half of the year.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Let us go on. And I think the next person up here is Champagne in line three. Hello.
Hi, I have three quick wives' tales that I want you to tell me if they're true or false.
Okay.
The first one is that you're supposed to open your windows when there's a tornado. The other one is that when it starts raining again, that it's okay to go outside and do whatever. And the last one is that when I lived in Danville, a teacher told me one time if a tornado hit inside the bowl of Danville, that it would just bounce around in there and basically destroy the whole town.
Okay, I never heard that one. I've heard a little bit about the first two, but not the last one. Opening windows, that is false. You shouldn't do that. That was the advice given in the 1960s and in some places into the early 1970s. And unfortunately, when bad advice has been given, it takes many, many years to wipe that out. The theory behind that was that the pressure inside a tornado is so low that if the tornado comes over your house, and the pressure is low outside and the air pressure is inside is high, your house is going to explode. So if you open the windows, that would equalize the pressure. Well, the tornado comes right over your house. The wind speed of the tornado is going to be strong enough to knock your house apart anyway.
Regardless.
And any time you take opening the windows is time that you're taking away from seeking shelter. And also, if you're opening the windows as the storm gets too close, you're putting yourself in great peril because more people are killed by flying debris, including broken glass, than anything else. So you don't want to waste any time with the windows at all. If a tornado's coming, go to your safe place, which is on the lowest floor of your building, and you want as many walls between you and the outside as possible. If you have a basement, getting under something sturdy, such as the staircase, is a good place to go. As far as the rain, some tornadoes come in a very dry part of a thunderstorm. Others are rain-wrapped. Just because it starts raining again doesn't necessarily mean you're safe. A lot of times there's not a lot of rain after a tornado either. So basically, you should just stay in the safe place until the all-clear is given. A lot of towns don't give an all-clear siren. Basically, what they'll do is if they haven't sounded the sirens for 30 minutes, then that's implied as being all clear. Unfortunately, sometimes around here I've heard the sirens go off a second time and people think it's an all clear. Whenever you hear the sirens in Champaign-Urbana, that means take cover. And if you've heard them once and they go off again, that means there's more.
Oh, okay.
So that's something to keep in mind. As far as the bowl of Danville, I can just tell you that a tornado would not bounce around Danville and destroy the whole city. Again, the stronger tornadoes are dictated, their direction's dictated on the clouds aloft and are not influenced that greatly by the terrain, at least the terrain that we have around here. We may think we have big ups and downs in the terrain, and in the Danville area there are valleys, the Vermilion River Valley and all, but compared to a lot of the country, it's still flat, and the big storms certainly can navigate over any terrain we have in central Illinois. And hopefully a tornado that, if there was ever the unfortunate incident of a big tornado hitting Danville, it would go straight through and get out of there then and not stay around and bounce around everywhere. So I wouldn't worry about that at all.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. We were talking a little bit earlier about reminding people that lightning can be very dangerous, and it's the kind of thing you want to respect and that people need to keep in mind. In fact, that as we said, that more people are killed by lightning than by thunderstorms. Another thing that I think
is— tornadoes.
Than tornadoes. More people killed by lightning than by tornadoes. Another thing I think it's probably good for people to keep in mind is that the number one cause of death associated with thunderstorms is flash flooding.
Exactly. More people die from flooding than from lightning. More people die from flooding than from tornadoes. And about half the people that are killed in floods are in vehicles. And it's very tempting when you're driving down the road to just keep on driving. But if the water even comes up halfway on your wheels, your car can be taken away. Yeah. And the flash flooding is a flood that comes up rather quickly. And around this part of the country, usually it's just a very heavy rainfall and the ditches and streams filling up very quickly and spreading out into the countryside. You get out west, sometimes a flash flood occurs where there's no thunderstorm. That's the scary thing. A thunderstorm could be up on a mountain.
Oh, yeah,
all this water
away.
Just comes down the canyon. Back in the 70s, the Big Thompson Canyon in Colorado is one where just this big wall of water came down the canyon. So if you're hiking or camping, especially out west, you want to keep track of the weather forecast because you may be in a dry place and all of a sudden a wall of water comes along. But that is the number one thunderstorm killer is flooding.
Yeah, that's what when we're doing our warnings in the spring and summer, that's that line is always in there. Is that, you know, if you're in a vehicle, don't try to cross rapidly moving water because that's the way an awful lot of people get into trauma.
And that does happen even in this part of the country. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. My apologies. We have a caller we can't take, but we've just come to the end of the time. One more reminder that if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to see Ed's Tornado Show. That will be April 13th. That's Tuesday?
Tuesday.
All right, it's Tuesday, April 13th, 7 o'clock in the evening at the auditorium at the Beckman Institute on the north end of campus. And it's free, and anybody who wants to attend should feel welcome.
Yeah, and we'll hopefully put on another good show this year. Like I said, we're earlier in the program. We're getting some new video in and incorporating that into the show. We try to have a few new twists every year.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, I enjoyed it. Time went fast.
All right. Our meteorologist, Ed Kieser. The show is made possible with support from the Sinfonia da Camera, presenting Beethoven's Violin Concerto with Sergiu Luca, Wellington's Victory, and Leonora No. 3. Complete the concert on Saturday, March 13th, 7:30 in the evening, in the Follinger Great Hall at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. For more information, call 333-6280. Program is also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's it for us here on Focus 580. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to head to the shopping mall with urban geographer, retail anthropologist, and entrepreneur Paco Underhill. His latest book is The Call of the Mall. Make that call of the mall, no the there. Let's take a look now at the latest prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. March wheat, 357 and three quarters, down 1 1/4. July wheat, 370, up 1. March corn, 295 and a quarter, up 3 1/2. July corn, 305, up 3. September corn, 297 and three quarters, up 3. December corn, 294 and a quarter, up 2.